This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today we read two stories from the October 1983 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. First, Spending a Day at the Lottery Fair by Frederick Pohl. They were the Baxter family, Randolph and Millicent, the parents, with their three children, Emma and Simon and Louisa, who was the littlest, and they didn't come to the fair in any old bus. No, they drove up in a taxi, all the way from their home, clear on the other side of town, laughing and poking each other, and when they got out, Randolph Baxter gave the driver a really big tip. It wasn't that he could really afford it. It was just because he felt it was the right thing to do. When you took your whole family to the lottery fair, Baxter believed, you might as well do it in style. Besides, the fair was only money. Though Millicent Baxter pursed her lips when she saw the size of the tip. She certainly was not angry. Her eyes sparkled as brightly as the children's, and together they stared at the facade of the lottery fair. Even before you got through the gates, there was a carnival smell. Buttered popcorn and cotton candy and tacos all around, and a carnival sound of merry-go-round organs and people screaming in the roller coaster and bands and bagpipes from far away. A clown stalked on tall stilts through the fairgoers lining up at the ticket windows, bending down to chuck children under the chin and making believe to nibble the ears of teenage girls in bright summer shorts. Rainbow fountains splashed perfumey spray. People in cartoon character costumes, Gus the Ghost and Mickey Mouse and Pac-Man, handed out free surprise packages to the kids. When Simon opened his, it was a propeller beanie, a fan for Emma, for little Louisa, cardboard glasses with a Groucho Marx mustache. And crowded, you could hardly believe such crowds. Off to one side of the parking lot, the tour buses were rolling in with their loads of foreign visitors, Chinese and Argentines and Swedes. They had special entrances and were waved through by special guards who greeted them, some of the time anyway, in their own native languages, Willkommen and bonjour and hey there, mate, as long as they didn't speak anything like Urdu or Serbo-Croatian anyway. For the foreign tourists didn't have to pay in the usual way. They bought their tickets in their country of origin with valuable foreign exchange, and then everything was free for them. Of course, it wasn't like that for the regular American fairgoers. They had to pay. You could see each family group moving up towards the ticket windows. They would slow down as they got closer and finally stop, huddling together while they decided how to pay. And then one or two of them, or all of them, would move on to the window and reach into the admissions cup for their tickets. Randolph Baxter had long before made up his mind that there would be no such wrangles on this day for his family. He said simply, "Wait here a minute," and strode up to the window by himself. He put his arm into the cuff, smiled at the ticket attendant, and said grandly, "I'll take five, please." The ticket seller looked at him admiringly. "You know," she offered, "there aren't that many daddies who'll take all the little fellows in like that. Sometimes they make even tiny babies get their own tickets." Baxter gave her a modest, "I do what I can," shrug, though he could not help that his smile was a little strained, until all five tickets clicked out of the roll. He bore them proudly back to his family and led them through the turnstiles. "My, what a crowd," sighed Millicent Baxter happily as she gazed around. "Now what shall we do first?" The response was immediate. "See the old automobiles," yelled Simon. "And no, the animals, and no, the stiffs," cried his sisters. Randolph Baxter spoke sharply to them, not angrily, but firmly. "There will be no fighting over what we do," he commanded. "We'll vote on what we do, the democratic way. No arguments and no exceptions. Now," he added, "the first thing we're going to do is that you kids will stay right here while your mother and I get tickets for the job lottery." The parents left the children arguing viciously among themselves and headed for the nearest lottery booth. Randolph Baxter could not help a tingle of excitement, and his wife's eyes were gleaming as they studied the prize list. The first prize was the management of a whole apartment building, a $25,000 a year salary, and a free 3-room condo thrown in. Millicent read his thoughts as they stood in line. "Don't you just wish?" she whispered. "But personally, I'd settle for any of the others. Look, there's even a job for an English teacher." Randolph shook his head wordlessly. It was just marvelous. 5 full-time jobs offered in this one raffle, and that not the biggest of the day. The last one, after the fireworks, always had the grandest of prizes. "Aren't you glad we came?" Millicent asked, and her husband nodded. But, in fact, he wasn't altogether, at least until they safely got their tickets and were on their way back to the children, and then he was quickly disconcerted to see that the kids weren't where they had been left. "Oh, hell," groaned Randolph, "it was early in the day for them to get lost." But they weren't very far. His wife said sharply, "There they are, and look what they're doing." They were at a refreshment stand, and each one of them had a huge cone of frozen custard. "I told them not to make any purchases when we weren't with them," Millicent cried. But, in fact, it was worse than that. The children were talking to a pair of strange grown-ups, a lean, fair, elderly woman with a sharp, stern face, and a round, dark-skinned man with a bald head and immense tortoiseshell glasses. As the Baxters approached, the woman turned to them apologetically. "Oh, hello," she said. "You must be the parents. I do hope you'll forgive us. Mr. Katsubishi and I seem to have lost our tour, and your children kindly helped us look for it." "It's all right, Dad," Simon put in swiftly. "They're on this foreign tour, see, and everything's free for them anyway. Dad, why can't we get on a tour and have everything free?" "We're Americans," his father explained, smiling tentatively at the tall, English-looking woman and the tubby, cheerful Japanese man. He decided that they didn't look like depraved child molesters. "You have to be an international tourist to get these unlimited tickets, and I bet they cost quite a lot of money, don't they?" He appealed to the man, who smiled and shrugged and looked at the woman. "Mr. Katsubishi doesn't speak English very well," she apologized. "I'm Rachel Millay, Mrs. Millay, that is, although me dear husband left me some years ago." She glanced about in humorous distress. "I don't suppose you've seen a tour leader carrying a green and violet flag with a cross of St. Andrew on it." Since Randolph Baxter had no idea what a cross of St. Andrew looked like, it was hard to say. In any case, there were at least 20 tour parties in sight, each with its own individual pennant or standard, trudging in determined merriment towards the pavilions, the rides, or the refreshment stands. "I'm afraid not," he began, and then paused as his wife clutched his arm. The PA system crackled, and the winners of the first drawing were announced. Neither of the Baxters were among them. "Well, there are 6 more drawings," said Millicent bravely. not adding that there were also 6 more sets of raffle tickets to buy if they wanted any hope of winning one of them. Her husband smiled cheerfully at the children. "What's it to be?" he asked generously. "The life exhibit? The concert?" "We already voted, Dad," cried Emma, his elder daughter. "It's the animals." "No, the stiffs," yelled her baby sister. "The old autos," cried Simon. "Anyway, there won't be any stiffs there until later, not to speak of." Baxter smiled indulgently at the foreigners. "Children," he explained, "well, I do hope you find your group." And he led the way to the first democratically selected adventure of the day, the space exhibit. Baxter had always had a nostalgic fondness for space, and this was a pretty fine exhibit, harking back to olden golden days when human beings could spare enough energy and resources to send their people and probes out towards the distant worlds. Even the kids liked it. It was lavish with animated 3D displays showing a human being walking around on the surface of the moon and a spacecraft slipping through the rings of Saturn, and even a probe, though not an American one, hustling after Halley's Comet to take its picture. But Randolph Baxter had some difficulty in concentrating on the pleasure of the display, at first because, as they were getting their tickets, the tall, smiling black man just ahead of him in line put his arm into the admissions cuff, looked startled, withdrew his arm, started to speak, and fell over on the ground, his eyes open and staring, it seemed, right into Randolph Baxter's. When you have a wife and 3 kids and no job, living on welfare, never thinking about tomorrow because you know there isn't going to be anything in tomorrow worth thinking about, then a day's outing for the whole family is an event to be treasured, no matter what the price, especially if the price isn't in money. So the Baxter family did it all. They visited 6 national pavilions, even the Paraguayan. They lunched grandly in the dining room at the summit of the fair's great central theme structure, the cenotaph, and they did the rides, all the rides, from the slosh-a-slide water chutes through the immense Ferris wheel with the wind howling through the open car and Simon threatening to spit down on the crowds below, to the screaming, shattering roller coaster that made little Louisa wet her pants. Fortunately, her mother had brought clean underwear for the child. When she sent the little girl off with her sister to change in the ladies' room, she followed them anxiously with her eyes until they were safely past the ticket collector, and then said, "Rand, honey, you paid for all those rides yourself." He shrugged defensively. "I want everybody to have a good time." "Now, don't talk that way. We agreed. The children and I are going to pay our own way all the rest of the day, and the subject is closed." She proved the point by changing it. "Look," she said, "there are those 2 foreigners who lost their tour group again." She waved, and Mrs. Millay and Mr. Katsubishi came up diffidently. "If we're not intruding," said Mrs. Millay, "we never did find our tour guide, you see, but actually we're getting on quite well without. But isn't it hot? It's never like this in Scotland." Millicent fanned herself in agreement. "Do sit down, Mrs. Millay. Is that where you're from, Scotland? And you, Mr. Katsubishi, he smiled with an abrupt, deep bow. Then he wrinkled his face in concentration for a moment and managed to say, "I, too, Scotland." Millicent tried not to look astonished, but evidently did not succeed. Mrs. Millay explained. "He from around Kyle of Lochalf, you know." Since Millicent obviously didn't know, she added, "That's the Japanese colony in northern Scotland, near my own home. In fact, I teach English to Japanese schoolchildren there, since I know the language. My parents were missionaries in Honshu, you see. Didn't you know about the colony? Actually, Millicent and Randolph did know about the colony, or at least they almost did, in the way that human beings exposed to 40 channels of television and with nothing much to do with their time have heard of, without really knowing much about, almost every concept, phenomenon, event, and trend in human history. In just that way, they had heard of the United Kingdom's pact with Japan, letting large Japanese immigration into an enclave in the north of Scotland. The Japanese made the area bloom both agriculturally and economically. The United Kingdom got a useful injection of Japanese capital and energy, and the Japanese got rid of some of their surplus population without pain. I wish we'd thought of that, Millicent observed in some envy, but her husband shook his head. Different countries, different ways, he said patriotically, and actually we're doing rather well. I mean, just look at the lottery fair. That's American ingenuity for you. Observing that Mrs. Millay was whispering a rapid-fire translation into Mr. Katsubishi's ear, he was encouraged to go on. Other countries, you see, have their own way of handling their problems. Compulsory sterilization of all babies born in even-numbered years in India, as I'm sure you're aware. The contraceptive drugs they put in the water supply in Mexico, and we don't even talk of what they're doing in, say, Bangladesh. Mrs. Millay shuddered sympathetically as she translated, and the Japanese man beamed and bowed, then spoke rapidly. He says one can learn much, Mrs. Millay translated, from what foreign countries do, even America. Millicent, glancing at the expression on her husband's face, said brightly, Well, let's not let this day go to waste. What shall we do next? At once she got the same answers from the children. Old cars, animals. No, whined baby Louisa. I want to see the stiffs. Mr. Katsubishi whispered something in staccato Japanese to Mrs. Millay, who turned hesitantly to Millicent Baxter. One doesn't wish to intrude, she said, but if you are, in fact, going to see the Hall of Life and Death, as your daughter suggests, well, we don't seem to be able to find the rest of our tour group, you see, and we would like to go there. After all, it is the theme center for the entire fair, as you might say. Well, of course, said Millicent warmly, we'd be real delighted to have the company of you and Mr. Katsubishi, he supplied, bowing deeply and showing all of his teeth in a smile, and they all seven set off for the Hall of Life and Death, with little Louisa delightedly leading the way. The hall was a low white marble structure across the greensward from the cenotaph, happy picnicking families on the green gay pavilions all around, ice cream vendors chanting along the roadways, and a circus parade, horses and a giraffe and even an elephant winding along the main avenue with a band leading them diddly-boom, diddly-boom, diddly-bang-bang-bang, all noise and color and excitement. But as soon as they were within the hall, they were in another world. The Hall of Life and Death was the only free exhibit at the fair. Even the restrooms were not free. The crowds that moved through the hall were huge, but they were also reverential. As you came in, you found yourself in a great domed entrance pavilion, almost bare except for 75 raised platforms, each spotlighted from a concealed source, each surrounded by an air curtain of gentle drafts. At the time the Baxters came in, more than 60 of the platforms were already occupied with silent, lifeless forms of those who had passed on at the fair that day. a sweet-faced child here, an elderly woman there. There, side by side, a young pair of newlyweds. Randolph Baxter looked for and found the tall, smiling black man who had died in the line before him. He was smiling no longer, but his face was in repose and almost joyous, it seemed. "He's at peace now," Millicent whispered, touching her husband's arm, and he nodded. He didn't want to speak out loud in the solemn hall, where the whisper of organ music was barely audible above the gentle hiss of chilled air curtains. Hardly anyone in the great crowd spoke. The visitors lingered at each of the occupied bureaus, but then, as they moved towards the back of the chamber, they didn't linger. Some didn't even look, for every tourist at the fair could not help thinking, as he passed an empty platform, that before the fair closed that night it would be occupied by someone. But the rotunda of those who have gone before was only the anteroom to the many inspiring displays the hall had to offer. Even the children were fascinated. Young Simon stood entranced before the great timepiece of living and dying, watching the hands revolve swiftly to show how many were born and how many died in each minute, with the bottom line always showing a few more persons alive in every minute, despite everything the government and the efforts of patriotic citizens could do. But he was more interested, really, in the mechanism of the thing than in the facts it displayed. Millicent Baxter and Mrs. Millay were really thrilled by the display of opulent caskets and cerements, and Randolph Baxter proud to point out to Mr. Katsubishi the working model of a crematorium with all of its escaping gases trapped and converted into valuable organic feedstocks. And the girls, Emma and Louisa, stood hand in hand for a long time, shuddering happily as they gazed at the refrigerated display cases that showed a hideous 4-month embryo next to the corpse of a fat, pretty 2-year-old. Emma moved to put her arm around her mother and whispered, "Mommy, I'm so grateful you didn't abort me." And Millicent Baxter fought back a quick and tender tear. "I'd never let you die looking like that," she assured her daughter, and they clung together for a long moment. But Randolph Baxter was becoming noticeably ill at ease. When they finally left the hall of life and death, his wife took him aside and asked in concern, "Is something the matter, hun?" He shrugged irritably at the foreigners who were talking together in fast, low-toned Japanese. "Just look at their faces," he complained. And indeed, both Mr. Katsubishi and Mrs. Millay's expressions seemed to show more revulsion than respect. Millicent followed her husband's eyes and sighed. There was a little annoyance in the sigh, too. "They're not Americans," she reminded her husband. "I guess they just don't understand." She smiled distantly at the foreign pair and then looked around at her offspring. "Well, children, who wants to come with me to the washrooms so we can get ready for the big fireworks?" They all did, even Randolph, but he felt a need stronger than the urging of his bladder. He remained behind with the foreigners. "Excuse me," he said somewhat formally, "but may I ask what you thought of the exhibit?" Mrs. Millay glanced at the Japanese man. "Well, it was most interesting," she said vaguely. "One doesn't want to criticize, of course." And she stopped then. "No, no, please go on," Randolph encouraged. She said, "I must say, it did seem odd to, well, glorify death in that way." Randolph Baxter smiled and tried to make it a forgiving smile, though he could feel that he was upset. He said, "Perhaps you missed the point of the fall of life and death, in fact, of the whole lottery fair. You see, some of the greatest minds in America have worked on this problem of surplus population. Think tanks and government agencies. Why, three universities helped design this fair. Every bit of it is scientifically planned. To begin with, it's absolutely free. Mrs. Millay left off her rapid-fire sotto voce Japanese translation to ask, "You mean free as far as money is concerned?" "Yes, exactly. Of course, one takes a small chance at every ticket window, and in that sense there is a price for everything. A very carefully computed price, Mrs. Millay, for every hot dog, every show, every ride. To get into the fair in the first place, for instance, costs 1 decimal. That's 1% of a 0.0001 probability of receiving a lethal injection from the ticket cup. Now, that's not much of a risk, is it?" he smiled. "And of course it's absolutely painless, too, as you can see by just looking at the ones who have given their lives inside." Mr. Katsubishi, listening intently to Mrs. Millay's translation in his ear, pursed his lips and nodded thoughtfully. Mrs. Millay said brightly, "Well, we all have our own little national traits, don't we?" "Now, really, Mrs. Millay," said Randolph Baxter, smiling with an effort, "please try to understand. Everything is quite fair. Some things are practically free, like the park benches and the restrooms and so on. Why, you could use some of them as much as 1,000,000 times before, you know, your number would come up. Or you can get a first-class meal in the cenotaph for just about a whole millipoint. But even that means you can do it 1,000 times on the average." Mr. Katsubishi listened to the end of Mrs. Millay's translation and then struggled to get out a couple of English words. "Not us," he managed, pointing to himself and Mrs. Millay. "Certainly not," Baxter agreed. "You're foreign tourists, so you buy your tickets in your own countries for cash, and, of course, you don't have to risk your lives. It wouldn't help the American population problem much if you did, would it?" he smiled. "And your tour money helps pay the cost of the fare. But the important thing to remember is that the lottery fare is entirely voluntary. No one has to come." "Of course," he admitted with a self-deprecatory grin. "I have to admit that I really like the job lotteries. I guess I'm just a gambler at heart, and when you've spent as much time on welfare as Mrs. Baxter and I have, those big jobs are just hard to resist, and they're better here than at the regular city raffles." Mrs. Millay cleared her throat. Good manners competed with obstinacy in her expression. "Really, Mr. Baxter," she said, "Mr. Katsubishi and I understand that. Heavens, we've had to do things in our own countries. We certainly don't mean to criticize yours. What's hard to understand, I suppose, is actually that fetus." She searched his face with her eyes, looking for understanding. "It just seems strange, I mean, that you'd prefer to see a child born and then perhaps die in a lottery than to abort him ahead of time." Mr. Baxter did his very best to maintain a pleasant expression, but knew he was failing. "It's a difference in our national philosophies, I guess," he said. "See, we don't go in for your so-called birth control here. No abortion, no contraception. We accept the gift of life when it is given. We believe that every human being, from the moment of conception, has a right to a life, although," he added, "not necessarily a long one." He eyed the abashed foreigners sternly for a moment, then relented. "Well," he said, glancing at his watch, "I wonder where my family can be. They'll miss the fireworks if they don't get back. I'll bet Mrs. Baxter's gone and let the children pick out souvenirs. The little Dickenses have been after us about them all day. Anyway, Mrs. Miller, Mrs. Katsubishi, it's been a real pleasure meeting the two of you and having the chance to exchange views." But he broke off, suddenly alarmed by the expression on Mr. Katsubishi's face as the man looked past him. "What's the matter?" he demanded roughly. And then he turned and did not need an answer. The answer was written on the strained, haggard, tear-streaked face of his wife as she ran despairingly towards him, carrying in her hands a plastic cup, a paperwork, and a helium-filled balloon in the shape of a pig's head, but without Emma and without Simon, and even without little Louisa. We continue with Downtown by Thomas M. Dish. 1. The House of Buckwheat. Berna Neville came on the floor at 11 after the breakfast rush and left at 7:30 when the House of Buckwheat closed. It might as well have closed after lunch. The afternoon business was so thin that all the downtown stores were obliged to subscribe to the illusion that their long decline had reached its nadir and that St. Paul was undergoing a renaissance. Berna didn't know anyone who really believed this. Even the owner of the House of Buckwheat, who cleaned out most of the bills from the register promptly at 2:30 and disappeared for the day, just in time to miss the desolation of the moment, around 3, when the music suddenly became not only audible but oppressive in its relentless peppiness. 15 minutes might go by of a stretch without anyone spinning the revolving door. The tips didn't amount to much, but Berna lived frugally and could get by well enough on just her salary. At 46, she didn't have the stamina for real waitressing, which was the reason she'd left the job at the hotel, aside from the fact that she could no longer abide the regular customers, bigwigs from the Chamber of Commerce and the state capital who were loud, abusive, and tight-fisted. At least the people who came into the House of Buckwheat didn't think they could treat you like a dog, expecting you to come at the snap of their fingers. In any case, rumor had it that the hotel would be closing soon. Maybe someday they'd just decide to shut down the entire downtown area. Berna first became aware of the woman in the green pantsuit during the quietest stretch of a Tuesday afternoon in April. Maybe she had come in other times earlier, but if so, Berna hadn't taken her in. The detail that made her notice the woman that day, apart from her being the only customer she had, was the fact of her coming in without a coat so early in the year, nothing but the pantsuit over a thin blouse. Berna hadn't thought it was that warm yet. She was about the same age as Berna, or a little older, with her hair knotted up into a bun that looked efficient, but not quite tidy. She ordered the House of Buckwheat's basic offering, 3 pancakes, butter and syrup, $1.25, which included all the coffee you wanted from the thermos jug on the table. This in itself seemed strange. Usually a new customer would indulge in something more exotic, waffles or blueberry pancakes. It was generally the customers who came in every single day and were beyond trying to pretend that pancakes were some kind of holiday who ordered the place's unmodified #1 platter. Stack 1. Customers liked the colored man who handled the ticket booth at the porno movie house around the corner on Wabasha, or the nurse from St. Luke's who came in every Wednesday and left a 50-cent tip. As it developed, the woman in the pantsuit became another of those regulars, and the only one who put in her appearance during the deadest hour of the afternoon. She always sat at the same table, away from the windows and out of sight of the cashier. She ordered her pancakes after consulting the menu Berna brought her, and ate them one at a time, carefully apportioning the 2 butter pats among them. When she was done, she would take a pack of cigarettes from her purse, a nice purse of wrinkled brown leather, and smoke a cigarette over her 2nd cup of coffee. She never looked around at the other people in the restaurant, and she never read a book or a newspaper. She didn't tip. Ordinarily, Berna would have resented that, but something about the woman made that inappropriate. How could you grudge a dime from someone who evidently had so little herself, who never wore anything but that same pantsuit day after day? It's green, as basic as the green in a box of color crayons, with the same off-white blouse, the same scuffed low heels. How could you feel anything but sorry? She was so thin and so pale, and her hands were so fumbly that almost every time she left the booth, there'd be a small puddle of coffee to wipe off the formica. She never acknowledged Berna as a familiar daily presence, and Berna, who had to wear a button on her uniform saying, "Hi, my name is Berna," regarded this as a civility rather than as coldness. Having to act friendly with customers was a strain she was glad to be spared. And anyway, Berna had a feeling that there was some connection between herself and the woman that went deeper than hellos and talk about the weather. But it was just a feeling, and Berna didn't have much use for feelings. Even so, towards the end of May, Berna began to be concerned for the woman. From her station near the service pass-through to the kitchen, she could watch the woman eating her three pancakes with such stolid mechanical chewing and swallowing, chewing and swallowing, that Berna could tell that the act involved neither appetite nor pleasure, but only the duty of supplying her body with calories. Berna felt similarly towards the process of eating, but for that very reason she ate a rational, balanced diet. She never touched the junk they served at the House of Buckwheat. Even the bacon was not to be trusted because of its nitrates, and she wanted to convey to the woman she served that she should not either. Could it be that this meal at 3 o'clock was the only meal the woman ate each day? Could she be that poor or that foolish? No one could stay healthy long on a diet of sugar, starch, and caffeine. It amounted to suicide. Did she know what she was doing? Indeed, was that what she was doing, or did the pancakes just represent, as they did for most of the House of Buckwheat's afternoon customers, an extra midday dessert? Berna didn't dare approach the woman and ask, and there was no other way to find out, short of hiring detectives or acting in that capacity herself, which she never could have done. All she could do, and all she did, was to take the woman's order and bring her her pancakes and leave her a check for $1.25. But she couldn't keep from wondering, and wondering led to noticing of a more particular order than Berna customarily was given to. She noticed that the woman's hair was very infrequently shampooed, and then not quite sufficiently. Similarly, her blouse went for weeks at a time without laundering. Berna noticed that the woman's hands seemed permanently soiled with a light pumice of ash, the dribbling of her cigarettes. She noticed that the seam down the side of her jacket had come unraveled, leaving a 3-inch gap that winked open and shut as the woman lifted and lowered her fork or her coffee cup or her cigarette. She noticed the smell she gave off, a sour pungency unlike any other human smell that Berna knew. Where would it stop, she wondered. At what point would the woman's dereliction become so pronounced that she would not be allowed into the restaurant? For the owner was insistent that the House of Buckwheat was not going to become a haven for undesirables, whatever might happen to the rest of downtown St. Paul. Berna couldn't bear such thoughts. She had managed over the last many and painful years to establish a day-to-day routine that protected her from emotional disequilibriums. In a crisis, she could get Valium. On the whole, it was a life she hated, but at least she was able to keep her sanity. She didn't want this stranger coming in every afternoon and upsetting her. At least she might have sat at one of the other waitresses' tables sometimes. With this in mind, Berna had once or twice kept the woman waiting menuless for inexcusable lengths of time. But the woman had just sat in the booth, seeming not to take offense, showing no signs of impatience. Eventually, Berna had to go over and take her order for 3 pancakes, butter, and syrup. She always mentioned the butter and syrup as though Berna might conceivably forget to include them in the order. Sometimes she was able to persuade herself that she was overreacting to the situation, that the woman wore this single change of clothing not from destitution, but as a kind of badge of defiance, as Berna felt she wore the House of Buckwheat's uniform of black dacron, a declaration that she would conceal her everyday despair no more than was absolutely required of her. But each day this became harder to believe, and Berna came round at last to the idea that the woman, simply, was dying, or rather was waiting for death to take hold. Berna never discussed the woman's plight with the other waitresses, though ordinarily they all came to know each other's regular customers and to speculate more or less freely as to where they worked and how they lived. As far as she could tell, they weren't even aware of the woman, who did not act in any way that would have drawn attention to herself. Even the cashier who took her money each day, always the exact amount in change, a stack of 5 quarters, never a bill, never accorded her any sign of special recognition as she slid to the other regulars. But then, neither did Berna. It was as though the woman was able to compel whomever she dealt with to mimic her own subdued and denatured plausibility. In July, the summer's first full-scale heat wave settled over St. Paul, and business at the House of Buckwheat slackened to a trickle even at lunchtime. No one wants pancakes in whatever combination with eggs, bacon, ice cream, or fruit sauce once the temperature has climbed above 90. The younger and less able of the other two afternoon waitresses was laid off, and Berna became responsible for the 2 window tables to the left of the cash register. But even these tables were seldom occupied. On the Friday of the 2nd week of the heat wave, the woman came in as usual to order her invariable 3 pancakes, butter, and syrup, but when Berna brought them to her, she didn't seem to notice. She sat there, touching the edge of the wood-paneled formica with her fingertips, for so long that Berna considered going back to the booth and asking if something was wrong with the order. Then the woman slid sideways into the corner of the padded seat, not suddenly or even alarmingly, but almost as though she'd fallen asleep. Her eyes closed and her mouth dropped open. Her arms hung limp at her sides. No one else had noticed. The cashier and the other waitresses were taking a coffee break at the window table on the far side of the register. The Muzak was playing a xylophone rendition of The Fool on the Hill. Berna was sure the woman was dead, but she could not bring herself to go over to the booth and make certain. She would have had to touch the woman, to try and rouse her on the assumption that she had only fainted, which was entirely possible in such weather. Berna couldn't think which would be worse, knowing positively that she was dead, or seeing her eyes opening, her lips forming some confused apology. Berna knew, in any case, that the woman was dead, so there was no point in going through the ordeal. She refused to. Instead, she went back through the kitchen to the windowless changing room, changed out of her uniform, and left the restaurant by the side door. She didn't excuse or explain her departure to anyone, even the cook, who was watching. 2. Butterworths. Once on the street, in that muggy heat, Berna realized there was nowhere she could go. She turned east so as to avoid passing in front of the restaurant windows, and when she came to the entrance to Butterworth's, she went inside for the sake of the air conditioning. The department store was almost as deserted as the House of Buckwheat had been. A girl in heavy eye makeup with bruises painted on her cheekbones stood idly glowering before a display of L'Air du Temps. Berna hurried through cosmetics and past counters draped with costume jewelry. In her haste, she almost knocked over a bin of purses on sale for $24.95. Each of the purses in the bin was identical to the purse of wrinkled brown leather carried by the woman in the green pantsuit. A bell rang, and a disembodied voice announced the closing of the store in another 15 minutes. The voice asked people to take their purchases to a cashier. Berna got on the up escalator and awaited the moment so lovely and so fleeting when she could rise above all the counters and partitions and could look out across the whole sales floor as though from a low-flying helicopter. The moment came and went. On two, she walked quickly through menswear and past the trellised entrance to Junior Miss, festooned this month with swimsuits and beach toys, to the unencumbered expanse of sportswear and casuals. For some reason, there was never any sales help in evidence in sportswear and casuals. For that reason, it was Berna's favorite department, and she had come here often to enjoy, at its full, the store's sense of peace and protectiveness. She ran her hand luxuriously along a rack of separates, all the same shimmery polyester jersey blend. The prettiest of the lot was a deep plum color, though there was also a cream-colored blouse nearly as nice. Not that it mattered. Berna would never have bought such a blouse for herself. To have bought anything the store offered would have seemed somehow to diminish its dignity. Butterworth's was the oldest department store in St. Paul, and beginning to show its years, but it was still the most respectable environment Berna knew of. You always felt safe in Butterworth's, partly because things were so expensive, partly because its few customers tended to be Berna's age or older. You never saw the riffraff here that sometimes came to the house of Buckwheat. Another bell rang, and Berna retreated from the threat of eviction by fleeing two floors higher to furniture. In past years, Butterworth's had had 6 sales floors, but competition with the new St. Paul branch of Dayton's and the general decline of the downtown had made retrenchment necessary, and 4 was now the highest sales floor. It was also the most beautiful, because the most unchanging. Berna always felt on 4 as though she'd returned to some long-forgotten family home. Here were the same ranks and files of armchairs, rockers, and recliners in Herculean and flowering chintz, the same array of sofas, coffee tables, and gigantic ceramic lamps, the same shining expanse of mahogany veneer and oak that had been here before Christmas, that would be here always. Berna negotiated the sea of tables, sideboards, and wardrobes, and came to the row of little rooms that ringed the elevator bank. Each little alcove featured a different style or texture. Here was a bedroom done all in butcher block, where large cubes of foam rubber were covered with a fabric their tags declared to be pecan illusion. In another alcove, an eye-blinding breakfast nook had been created all in white. In the next, a single bookcase, innocent of books, loomed over an upright piano. The piano's cover was lowered chastely over the keyboard and supported a discreet cardboard sign. Please refrain from playing pianos and organs. Our sales staff will be happy to assist you. Miss Neville? A voice asked, the same voice, though now unamplified, that had announced the closing of the store. She turned round to confront the floor manager, as the badge on the best pocket of his gray pinstripe suit proclaimed him. None of his other features, the neatly trimmed hair, the eyes shadowed by the frames of his glasses, the pleasant but perfunctory smile, told anything more of him than the badge. "Yes?" she said, deferring at once to his authority, not questioning that he should know her name. "Would you follow me, please?" He led her along a dim-lighted corridor of blind windows, displaying various styles of curtains and draperies. At the end of the corridor was a narrow escalator with wooden treads, barred by a small chain. The floor manager removed the chain and began climbing the steps of the motionless escalator. Berna hesitated before following him to the higher floor, but for a moment only. Berna, if she had thought about it, would have expected Five to be a jumble of stacked boxes and naked, dusty mannequins, but it presented, on the contrary, an even cheerier and more homelike atmosphere than the floor below, though its arrangement was at first glance not so orderly. A four-poster bed loomed up from a welter of enormous African baskets. A long, modular couch wound river-like past console TVs and waterfall racks of carpet samples, past wooden cradles filled with magazines and a sideboard bustling with china figurines, coming to rest at last beside an oak roll-top desk, sale priced for $959.95. The floor manager pulled up a rush-bottom chair to the desk, one of a set of four that sold for $125, and gestured to Berna to be seated in another. "Well, this is where we live." "I beg your pardon," said Berna, unconsciously imitating the floor manager's formal manner. "This is where we live," he repeated a little impatiently. "Here, and on 6. Berna looked about the sprawling space of the abandoned sales floor for some clue to the floor manager's riddle. "At first it may seem, not very private, but each of us has his or her own private space tucked away out of sight, in addition to the sales floor proper, and at night, of course, we have the run of the store, though there especially we must exercise discretion." "You mean all of the people who work at Butterworth's?" The floor manager allowed himself a small laugh. "Goodness no, Miss Neville, most of the employees have no idea, would even say it were impossible. Only a select few, myself, the two-night watchman, Mr. Richardson, who, I should warn you, has something of a drinking problem, and a number of ladies, like yourself and Joan, who can be trusted to, how shall I say, live quietly." "Joan? That's to say, Miss Emery. Among ourselves, we tend to be informal. Joan, of course, is a special case, having lived here longest. She'd been in charge of Toy World, for years and years. But when Toy World was moved to the basement and the upper floors were closed, Miss Emery was terminated, only a few months short of her retirement." He swiveled his head once to the left and once to the right in stiff-necked reprobation. "Miss Emerling," he continued, "had few resources. She lived in a residence hotel and spent her entire salary on keeping herself looking smart. One must, you know, in this business, take great care of one's appearance." Berna nodded. "So what was to be done? She'd been thrown virtually into the streets. She was not in the best health, though she never complained. She was too old to find other employment. Toys had been her entire life. Something had to be done, and here, in the very building that was her second home, were two entire floors standing empty. So she moved here? Would you like to meet her?" he asked in a bright, salesman-like tone that could only be answered in the affirmative. He pushed his chair back and rose, offering his hand to Berna. She followed him back along the stream of the modular sofa and around a stack of imported goatskin accent rugs and through a dense cluster of lawn furniture. There, the sales floor angled around the elevator bank to become, as on the floor below, a concourse of individual rooms. In the first of these rooms, a kind of boudoir, or bedless bedroom, the woman in the green pantsuit stood beside the gauzy curtains covering a cardboard window. She seemed, in the dim light of the alcove,
much younger, even in a subdued way, attractive. "Miss Emmerling," said the floor manager, "this is Miss Neville. Miss Neville may be joining us." Miss Emmerling smiled at Berna. "We've met," she said. Her voice seemed completely different than it had in the House of Buckwheat when she would give her order, lower, clearer, authoritative. "But we've never gotten to know each other, really, though I knew, without our ever speaking, that you were meant to be one of us. Isn't that strange? I knew." "Well, if you two ladies will excuse me," said the floor manager, backing out into the shadows. When he was gone, Miss Emmerling asked Berna if she smoked. She said she didn't. "You'll excuse me if I do," said Miss Emmerling, and took a package of cigarettes from her purse, which lay on the black glass surface of a vanity table. "I thought," Berna began. "Yes," said Miss Emmerling, lifting one eyebrow ironically as she touched the tip of her cigarette with the lighter's flame. But Berna could not bring herself to say that she had thought that Miss Emmerling was dead. It would have seemed both ridiculous and impolite. So instead she asked, "How did you know I'd come here?" Miss Emmerling considered this and asked in turn, "Why did you?" "For no reason. It was instinctive. I've always liked it here." Miss Emmerling nodded. "Yes, there's something quite special about Butterworths. It's, we all feel something." "There's no one who'll miss me," Berna declared, startling herself by her own boldness. "No one at all out there, and I won't miss them." Without really laughing, Miss Emmerling made a face expressive of laughter. "Look," she said, lifting her hand, "I have something here that's just for you." She went to the rosewood armoire that stood in the corner and opened it. On the side of the door was a mirror, and inside the armoire, on a hanger, was the blouse with the ruffled collar. "Do you like it? It's beautiful." "Let me," said Miss Emmerling, taking the blouse from the armoire and undoing its mother-of-pearl buttons. Berna undid her blouse and let it slip to the floor. She turned her back to Miss Emmerling and lifted her arms. Miss Emmerling slipped the blouse over her arms and onto her shoulders in a single deft motion. Then, smiling, she adjusted the door of the armoire so that Berna could see herself in its mirror. And Berna, returning her smile, vacuous, melancholy, the immemorial smile of all mannequins, raised her delicately jointed fingers to touch the topmost button of the plum-colored blouse, amazed by her own changeless beauty. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.